morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Inside the Writer Studio is also proud to be an affiliate of Libro FM, the audiobook platform that supports your local independent bookstore. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information on Libro FM and a special offer. My guest today is Stephen McCauley, whose novel You Only Call When You're in Trouble was published in January. Stephen, welcome to Inside the Writer Studio.
Thanks for having me on, Charlie.
So your opening few sentences in this novel are all about choosing the right words. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about the opening, why you wanted to open the book this way, but also about your technique for choosing the words to get a sentence or a phrase just right, both linguistically and emotionally.
Yeah, you know, that opening little chapter, I guess it's reads a little bit like a prologue or an introduction, was the last thing that I wrote for the novel. And I wasn't anticipating beginning that way at all. In fact, for a couple of years when I was writing the book, I began it with what is essentially, you know, one of the last chapters in the novel currently. And the idea of this, the woman who narrates this chapter, or is her point of view in any case, Dorothy, trying to choose the right words, was really about the character's need to balance being honest and actually hiding the truth of much of her life. And one of my favorite lines in that is that she said she hated to be considered by a liar by her daughter, especially as a result of telling the truth. And there was something about her relationship to truth and lies that was very important to me. So I have her writing several drafts of this email that she wants to send her daughter, and eventually finding the right one, but failing pretty miserably in a sense. As for myself, you know, I'm a very slow writer. It's very intimidating for me to talk with someone as prolific as you are, who's, you know, I take a long time trying to get the wording right and in my sentences. And I think that is especially important because I write in a kind of what I hope comes off as a somewhat comedic vein, or at least there's certainly an element of the comic in a lot of my work. And, you know, just as in, I suppose, stand up, which I have never done, you know, myself, that timing is really, really important. Yeah. And so getting the right number of words in a sentence to land what you hope is a kind of punchline is very important and something that I work on a great deal.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the setup and about the main characters of You Only Call When You're in Trouble.
Yeah, there are three main characters. I suppose the real heart and soul of the novel is Tom, and he's an architect who is approaching his mid-60s, like me, although I have said before we're approaching it from different directions, unfortunately. And he's spent his whole life taking care of his younger sister, Dorothy, who is a lovable, optimistic, encouraging person, but someone who has been pretty irresponsible her whole life in terms of finances and career choices. And Dorothy has a daughter who's now 34 years old, and she is kind of the love of Tom's life, someone he has taken care of since she was a baby, really, and been there as the person who she could fall back on when her mother has failed her in various ways. And so it's about the moment in Tom's life when he decides, you know what, have this one last chance. He's an architect. I have this one last chance to build what is essentially my masterpiece and leave a footprint on the planet in that way. But I can only do this if I disregard any cries for help. And of course, that's when the sister and her daughter call him. And, you know, will he answer the call? Yes, of course.
So we'll talk about Dorothy for just a minute. This is the sister. And we meet her in this sort of prologue that you were just talking about. And she's talking about this alteration to a building that she's involved with, which she doesn't particularly care for. And she says this great thing. She says, she'd do what she'd always done, fake loving it in the hope that eventually she really would. That hadn't worked with her first boyfriend or ex-husband, but it had been an effective strategy with Sushi and T.S. Eliot. I mean, obviously we see the comedy coming in there, but tell us about this idea of Dorothy and fake loving. Why did you want that to be sort of, it's one of the first things that we learn about her.
Yeah. Again, it's really this question of her relationship to truth. And I just find that I pursue this in a lot of my novels and in various different ways. And I think that for me, like, the real journey of the character is going from this place where she feels that faking liking something is more or less the same thing as really liking it, to facing some real hard truths about herself. And I think that's kind of the journey for all of the characters in the book. You know, what do you really want? What is it that you've really created in your life? I think that, you know, when you get to be a certain age, like the age I'm at, that a lot of chickens come home to roost and you begin dealing with the consequences of your actions. And I think Dorothy is beginning to feel the consequences of some of her less than truthful ways she's lived her life. So that, and that line, those lines that you read were just kind of my way of introducing in a somewhat ironic way, I suppose, what that looks like for her.
So Dorothy is about to go into business with this sort of self-help, I guess, guru, for want of a better name, named Fiona. And Fiona says something that really stood out to me. She says, I'm good at bullying people. And then you go on to write, like most professionals who work revolves around self-help, it was true of Fiona. Tell us a little bit about this dynamic between Fiona and Dorothy, and why it is that you think Fiona's chosen career kind of amounts to bullying.
Well, there was a period in my life, I think, this was quite a while ago, maybe like the 1970s even, when there were a lot of self-help books on the market. And I was young at that point, and I was trying to, find the right path in life, which, by the way, is something I've completely given up on, obviously. But read things like I'm Okay, You're Okay, and some of these other big self-help books. And it just strikes me that the purpose of all of these is to convince you that there's something wrong with you, that you're not living your life in the proper way, sort of like diet books, you know, or fitness books, like, you know, there's something wrong with your body. There's something wrong with your, with the way you're eating and so on. And I'm going to tell you how to fix it. And to me, there's an inherently bullying quality to that, which is masked as altruism, you know, like I'm going to save you in some way. And that's Fiona's mission, when her real motive just seems to be her own, you know, make a livelihood. And she hoped to be a little bit more famous and successful than she actually is, like most of us. Speaking for myself.
So now we have, we'll get to now Cecily. This is Dorothy's daughter. And she says something early on, that sort of connects with her her academic career that she's always been fascinated by people who act in opposition to their own best interest. And I wonder if that is an idea that plays out in the lives of all the characters in this novel. And if you could speak to that a little bit, and also speak to, do you think it's something universal that we're all guilty of at one time or another?
I think we're all guilty of it, you could say, in one form or other. Yeah, at different moments, for a variety of reasons. She was referring to it specifically in this academic book that she wrote that became a kind of surprise success, in terms of politics. You know, why do she was examining specifically, you know, why do women vote for political figures who maybe don't have the best interests of women at heart? And I think that ultimately what she's doing is examining her mother's life and her mother's motivations, because her mother goes into these businesses that ultimately fail. Her mother has had problems with men and with drugs for a lot of her life. And I think that, you know, her academic exploration, and the line that you quote, is really her attempt to look at her mother's life with a little bit more clarity and try and understand it. You know, why doesn't her mother make sound financial decisions? You know, why is she always investing in some questionable business or investment scheme?
There's a scene early in the book with Cecily, which we could talk about for several different reasons, but I want to focus on it for a second. And that is when she has lunch with her boyfriend's mother. And I wondered if you could use that scene as an example to talk to us a little bit about how you write a great scene that has compelling characters and layered conflict, because that, you know, you don't think of a scene like two people sitting at a table. That doesn't automatically seem compelling, but this is a great scene. Can you talk a little bit about how you structured that?
Well, thank you for interpreting it as a good scene. I mean, you know, I think that you have, in that scene, I had two characters who are connected by a third person, which is to say it's Cecily's boyfriend's mother. And Cecily has a very strong desire to have a good relationship with this woman, because she knows that to some extent or other, her domestic romantic relationship depends upon her having a good relationship with her, in essence, mother-in-law. And the mother-in-law does not really like Cecily. She's like 2 years older than her son, which she thinks is wrong. And she understands. And the other thing that kind of drives the scene is that, at least for a portion of it, there's a secret. The mother-in-law knows something about Cecily and about a dilemma that she is facing in her professional life that Cecily doesn't realize she knows about. And so pretty much every line that each of them says is loaded with some ulterior motive. And that, to me, is just like the most fun scene to write, you know, because people are just at cross purposes, and there's just, you know, shifting power dynamics throughout. Although actually Cecily's boyfriend's mother really has the upper hand almost from the beginning. So,
I mean, that having just come off of doing a stage adaptation of one of my novels, that scene made me think about playwriting a lot, because, you know, when playwriting, you want to, it's all about economy, right? You have a limited amount of time. And so you want every line that somebody says to have multiple layers of meaning. And I love moments in playwriting where characters don't listen to each other, you know, and it was all going on in that scene. Let's move
on. Non sequiturs and
because that's the way we talk, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's move on to Tom, who, as you said, is, if there is a central character in the novel, I think it's Tom. Tom is one of those characters that, the kind of character I really like, because I love him, and at times I want to grab him by the collar and say, no, do this thing over here. You're doing it wrong. Right. But Tom is an architect, and I wondered if you could talk about, you know, the parallels between the career of an architect and the career of a novelist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're obviously they're both creative professions. I think they're both professions that are maybe look a little bit more, I don't want to say the glamorous, but maybe more impressive from the outside than they do from the inside. I interviewed a bunch of architects when I was writing this novel, and everyone, you know, kind of complained about the fact that they're underpaid, that from the outside people think, oh, well, you know, Frank Gehry or something, and that has a lot of status that in fact it doesn't, you know, quite play out that way. And I think that that's similar to being a writer at times, certainly. For me, it was important that he be an architect because buildings and houses and home, you know, is just central to me in everything that I've written. People's search for a place that they can identify as home. And one of the inspirations for this book really was this building that it was owned by a friend in Woodstock, New York. It was this big rambling, you know, white elephant of a building. And that's where I put Dorothy, you know, just kind of, she purchases this house and is saddled with it. And it's way too big for what her needs are. And Tom's focus is building small spaces and, you know, space, economy of space, which is kind of something I chose because I really like small spaces and I'm very comfortable in small spaces. And I wanted to indulge in that, you know, in my writing. But of course, it fits his personality perfectly because he's someone who doesn't want to take up too much space in the world.
Tom describes architecture as destiny. He says architecture is destiny. What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that architects would like you to live in their houses as they imagine you living in them. And, you know, the most extreme, or certainly an extreme example of that is, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, who, you know, like, is the furniture is just built into the walls. You can't change it. You've got to sit here and look out that window and so on and so forth. And I think to a surprising degree that, I mean, this is true for me, that where I'm living determines kind of the quality of my days and what my habits are to some extent or other. And so I think it's both a truth that he's speaking, but also maybe a little bit of a kind of, you know, wishful thinking that you can control someone's life through architecture. He's building a tiny, a guest house for a friend of his, and he has very specific ideas about what it's supposed to look like, but at the same time, he wants it to help her contain some of the drama of her life and maybe rethink it in certain ways.
Yeah. It strikes me, I've lived in the same house for 25 years now, and we've built additions and we've done renovations and we've done, you know, I'm sure the original architect, because it was a custom house, if the original architect came back, he might be horrified or he might think it was wonderful. But I feel like I've shaped my house, but my house has shaped me also. Just the decision to buy this particular home has led my life in directions that another home would not have. So
that's interesting. In what way?
Well, I mean, I think some of it is a house that was built for entertaining. It's a house that is not, it's sort of hidden away from its neighbors. So maybe it's made me more of a, you know, not hermit, but, you know, less connected to my neighbors than I might've been otherwise. And yet, more excited about having 35 people over for an author's dinner or something like that. You know, I don't know. It's just, it's a strange relationship we have with the places that we live in, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that's particularly true of the ability to host people. And I know, you know, some people who live near me in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, who are always doing that, like having authors dinners or events after a reading or something because they've got the space for it and because there's something about the quality of the space that is really conducive for that. So,
well, there was something you mentioned about Tom that earlier, which I found that really liked, because I feel like we're living in a literary landscape these days, and I'm guilty of this too, where a lot of our heroes in the novels that we read are, you know, the age of my children or younger. And Tom is my age, basically. I mean, he's in his 60s, which is refreshing for me being in my 60s. But what do you accomplish? And taking away the fact that he is of a similar age to yourself, what do you accomplish by writing a character in his 60s that's different from writing a 30-year-old hero or 35-year-old hero?
I'll just start off by saying personally, what it accomplishes for me is that this is my eighth novel. It's technically my 10th novel because I wrote two that were published under a pseudonym. But what I realize, of course, should have been obvious to begin with, is that in each of my novels, the characters are, the main characters are aging at about the same rate that I'm aging. And so although none of my novels is truly autobiographical, for example, I don't have a sister, I'm not an architect, I'm nowhere near as generous emotionally or financially as Tom is, that there's a way in which they're kind of form maybe a little bit of an emotional autobiography in a sense, in that the characters, to some extent, to a great extent actually, see the world the way I do, and it gives me kind of a mouthpiece for my observations of life at this stage of life, you know. And I cheat on it a little bit in this novel because I have at least two other points of view, one of Dorothy, who's a slightly younger woman, and Cecily, who's 34 years old. So there are other points of view, but just as the guiding, you know, idea, that's what it, I guess what it accomplishes for me is it allows me to express my views of the world in a sense.
And I think that's, you know, it's done subtly, because there are places where I would go back and I would say, oh yeah, Tom said something about life. And then I go back and I look at the paragraph and I go, oh, wait a minute, that's not in quotation marks. Tom didn't say that. Actually, Stephen said that. but you, the way you weave that in, I think is really nice, where we're in the context of the lives of other characters, but there is room for sort of authorial commentary. You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting away from the fact that we're always, to some extent or other, you know, creating the world through the lens of our own experience as writers. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's what makes work interesting. And even people like yourself who write very, very diverse kinds of novels, you know, that there's a guiding aesthetic or point of view that connects them all. And that's what makes me want to read things.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this relationship between Tom and Cecily and the reasons. Can you sort of explore the reasons behind this sort of intensity of his feelings for her? Because he says this is the most important relationship in his life.
Yeah. So there are a few reasons for it. One is that Dorothy, his sister, has this child, raises this, you know, is claims that she can't contact the father. There's a whole complicated reason for that I won't get into, but is, you know, very much a single mother, raising her daughter on her own. And as we've already discussed, is someone who is not terribly responsible in terms of finances and caretaking. And as soon as he picks this infant up in the hospital, he looks at her and he feels as if she's saying to him, you know, you're going to take care of me, aren't you? And he promises her that that he will. And that carries on through the rest of his life. And there is also another reason, which is that Tom, who's gay, His own father died very suddenly when he was in his early 20s, I think. And his mother kind of implies when she's talking to him that the father had, I believe it's an aneurysm. I honestly don't remember now how I killed off the father, but that it's because the father, you know, read some journal of Tom's that he left behind when he went off to college, discovered that Tom was probably gay and was just so upset about it. So he's carrying around this terrible burden of guilt and he's trying to make good on all that. Really for the rest of his life. And, you know,
And Cecily, I think you might've mentioned this, but if not, Cecily works in academia and we find out early on that she's the subject of some sort of investigation. But she said something that really struck me. I mean, my father worked in academia for 40 years, but retired in 2002, I think. And so I had that connection to that world for a long time and saw how it evolved and have seen how it's evolved since then to a certain extent. But she says, in academia, discomfort of any kind was increasingly equated with trauma. Cecily's instincts were always to make her students as comfortable and at ease as possible. But another part of her thought that some of this was the equivalent of infantilizing 20-year-olds at the exact moment they should be trained for adulthood. And I just wondered if, what your assessment is of this balance between in academia and anywhere else between comfort and between real learning, which sometimes happens most effectively at, I think, at least in my life, at points of discomfort.
Yeah. Well, I began teaching, at the college level in 1987, shortly after my first novel was published. And hasn't been really steady, you know, but it's been pretty steady. So I would say I've probably been teaching for at least 30 years, if not longer. And it has changed a lot, you know, and I mean, that's an example, the lines that you just read of something that's given to the character of Cecily, but really comes from my own feelings about my profession, this other part of my profession, which is a teacher, and really wanting to improve the lives of my students and not make them unhappy or miserable or triggered, to use a very trendy word, but at the same time recognizing that there is increasingly a lot of infantilizing that I see in academia of students, that if you assign a story that contains any number of things that you're supposed to put a trigger warning on it. You're supposed to tell them that, you know, you don't have to read this if this is going to be upsetting to you. The most extreme example of this was, because I teach mostly creative writing classes, a student who turned in a story and she had, and this was not ironic, had a trigger warning on the top, you know, trigger warning, this story contains food. And, I guess she was concerned about students who have, you know, eating disorders or whatever. But to me, it was just the ultimate example of like somebody's going to be triggered by something. And let's just learn from this experience. I mean, that's what art is. That's what literature is. As you say, you know, it's not knowing, it's the discomfort of what you're not familiar with and what you're not at ease with that pushes you to examine yourself and to learn more. Mm-hmm. So
we're about 60 pages into the novel, and I'm not going to say the details of this, but we're about 60 pages into the novel when we discover the details of why Cecily is being investigated. And I've had this discussion on the show a lot with people who write mysteries and thrillers, but we haven't talked about it that much in other genres. And that is this question of how do you know when it's time to tell the reader a certain piece of information? How do you decide how to dole things out and not let them know too much too soon, but also not let them know so little that they're confused or uninterested in what's going on?
Yeah, Well, I mean, the question sort of implies that I know how to do that, and I'm not sure I do. But you know, that was just an instinctive move on my part. I mean, I just thought it would be more interesting if the reader didn't know the exact circumstances surrounding the accusations that were made against Cecily, because it's all kind of a gray area. You know, Cecily is certainly not guilty of the things that she's accused of, but she is responsible for, you know, behaving in certain ways that she could, you know, she could have behaved more appropriately in terms of, you know, just putting limits on the even the intellectual advances of her student, you know, which led to misunderstanding and so on. And I wanted the reader to be a little bit unclear about maybe there was a possibility she had done something, you know, sexually inappropriate, which was the accusation. And that it would benefit the story to kind of hold back that information some.
So Tom is dealing with the presence of this new and younger employee in his architecture firm who might potentially end up taking his job. Cicely's dealing with a younger student who might put an end to her job if this investigation doesn't go her way. What role does this, just to use a trendy 70s term, this generation gap and the perspective of different generations play in the novel?
You know, it plays a big role. I mean, the review of this novel in People magazine said something about, you know, like entertaining observations about academia and aging, which was meant in a complimentary way. And I thought, well there goes the sales of this book. who wants to read about that? But yeah, I mean, it's a lot about, look, I mean, I don't know if you experience this, but I, as a person in his 60s, I certainly experience even a certain amount of guilt about wanting more success or wanting people to read my books, you know, thinking that, like, well, just, you know, you've had your moment. Open the door for the next wave. And I mean, some of that happens inevitably anyway. But it is a question that I wouldn't say I struggle with, but I certainly think about a lot. And ultimately you just kind of move on and do the next thing. But you know, and I'm at a point right now where, you know, as I said, I've been teaching for many years, and some of my students are getting published now and are getting more attention than I'm getting and so on. And, you know, and you have to kind of readjust what your role is in their lives. And fortunately, as I've gotten older, I have just been able to enjoy that more and more, like enjoy their success and welcome it.
One of the things I've enjoyed about being in the writing community is, as you might guess from the way I'm dressed today, I'm a runner also. And when you go out into one of these big road races, you know, people aren't competing against each other. People are all cheering for one another, and it's all about just finishing the course and maybe competing against the clock. And I feel like writing is that way too, that it's a very supportive community, that when I talk to other writers, even if they're writing something very similar to me, I don't see that as a competition. I see that as like a brotherhood, you know?
Yeah. That's the ideal, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think it would be maybe a little too optimistic to think that there's not a certain amount of competition.
Well,
you know,
I mean, you want people to read your books, and you know, there's a limited number of people and a limited number of hours of reading that they're going to do. So yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I find as I get older, I really have put a focus on like nurturing my contentment with where I am in my life, because there aren't that many opportunities to change it radically, and along with that comes like truly enjoying other people's success and like really feeling that, because like the opposite is very uncomfortable. And why make yourself miserable? You know, why not just enjoy it?
One of the things that Tom said, that he says a lot of things that, that strike me, but he says that he believes that narcissism is an essential element of all dictatorships and most innovation. And I wondered if you could unpack that for us a little bit, and also tell me if you think it's an essential element of novel writing. I mean,
oh, don't you? I mean, you know, you're sitting in a room by yourself, creating conversations and situations for imaginary people, and expecting others to spend a piece of their lives, you know, reading it and engaging with it. And I think that there's something incredibly arrogant about that. I think it's wonderful, you know. But I think, you know, as someone who throughout his life has struggled with a lot of just like, I am not worthy kind of self-esteem, you know, issues, it's a real double-edged sword, you know, that it's like, you feel like, oh, why would anyone want to read my work? And then at the other hand, it's like, why wasn't it on the Times bestseller list? You know, it's that kind of feeling. So,
yeah, it is. It's funny how you can hold in your mind at the same time, well, my book is so much better than these bestsellers over here. And then you can be simultaneously thinking, why would anybody want to read this thing that I just made up? Can't they see that it's phony? I made it up, you know?
Right. And writing contradictions like that for my characters is one of my favorite parts of writing, you know, is just sort of like diving into that and appreciating the truth of it and also the comic potential in it, because it's both touching and sad in some respects and also absurd and very funny.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned comic potential. I want to go back to your use of humor for just a second. We heard it in that quote about T.S. Eliot and sushi. But I'm curious how you know, not only when is it time to drop in a joke or a bon mot, but when I'm watching a play on stage, I can see whether one of my jokes is landing or not, because I get this immediate reaction from an audience. But how do you know in a novel if it's working? You know, you talked about timing before. How do you know the timing is right? How do you know the joke is landing when it's just ink on a page?
You know, that's the great thing about writing a novel. You don't know. So you don't have to, you know, face the humiliation of something that you thought was just hilarious falling completely flat on its face. I've written a couple of plays, like children's musicals, actually. I've worked with some friends on these children's musicals and that were comedic. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I would sit in the audience and wait for these lines that I just thought were kind of bring down the house. You know, they were so funny. And sometimes it happened and a lot of times it didn't. And of course, a lot of that depends on the delivery as well. But, you know, I think that for me, it's really important that there be some, you know, this line about the T.S. Eliot and sushi and so on. I mean, you know, it's a little bit absurd, but there's also some truth in that, you know, for people, of how people live their lives. And I don't think it's funny unless there's some real strong element of human behavioral, psychological truth in the lines, you know.
I also wrote children's plays for many years, and it was always fun to watch the different reactions between the audience of, say, kindergartners versus an audience of parents, you know, where the little kids would laugh at all the physical humor and the silliness, and the adults would understand the more sophisticated jokes. But we had to tell the young actors, like, you have to be ready for anything. You can't. And but that does bring up this issue of watching your characters that you've created in a novel take on their own life through actors and adaptations. And as I said, I just a week and a half ago did an adaptation of, well, I've been writing it for many years, but saw the world premiere of a play that was based on one of my novels. And I wonder what it's like for you to watch those film adaptations, and to see these characters that you've created sort of, you know, taken over by somebody else.
You know, so three of my books were adapted for movies, one here and two in France. And in the one here was so different from the novel that in certain respects, it was kind of, I don't know, blessing is too strong of a word, but it was a good thing because I didn't get that invested in it. I knew immediately the screenplay was written by Wendy Wasserstein, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and so on. And I knew as soon as she was hired, which I was grateful for, that it would be her aesthetic and her sense of comedy and her world. And it truly was. And so I could recognize like some ghostly similarities, but you know, there was not one line of dialogue in the movie that was from the novel. And yeah. So I've said that it's kind of like having a dinner party and inviting and, you know, like all these people you didn't invite showed up, but they seem to be having a great time. So you just kind of go with it, you know?
So the tagline for this book, and you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but you know, at the top of the, we always have to, as authors, we always have to do this where they say, okay, come up with one line that summarizes your whole complex novel. And that's I think it's one of the most difficult tasks to do, especially when it's a character-driven piece like this. But anyhow, the line is it ever okay to stop caring for others and start living for yourself? And I wondered if you could sort of, without giving too much away, just sort of tease out how that line applies to these three main characters in the novel and whether or not you have an answer to that question.
You know, I have an answer that there's no message in this book. There's really no, I don't try to, you know, force a message in any of my novels. I hope that I view them as entertainment, hopefully kind of semi-intelligent adult entertainment, but I do feel, I mean, my own self, I really kind of value good citizenship and being a responsible member of a community, whether that's a family or a neighborhood or a condo association or, you know, what it is, academia. And I feel as if that's being a little bit devalued at this current moment in time in various ways. And I wanted to make a case for the value in making sacrifices for other people. And, you know, I feel as if I'm, again, kind of looking at my life and thinking, gee, I spent all this time teaching, and maybe if I had been teaching less, I would have been writing more. But there's no going back. And so what I've come to, and it's sort of come to me in a very genuine way, is just appreciating that, you know, teaching has been a part of my creative life. It's been an essential part. It's had some value. I'm sure there are a lot of students who would forgot that class and hated it and so on, but others whose lives were positively impacted by it, even in a very small way. And that's kind of what I was trying to come to at the end of this novel, is the value in making sacrifices for other people.
We like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each of them in just a few words, but hopefully they'll give us a little more insight into you and into your writing. So we will begin. What word do you love to work into your writing?
Apparently, that word is vague, because when I go through my manuscripts, the word vague just pops out all over the place, like a vague discomfort, a vague sense of pleasure, whatever it is. So I don't like putting it in, but I subconsciously, apparently I do.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Any word that sends me rushing to the dictionary.
Where's your favorite place to write?
That's very easy. My favorite place to write is in the top floor of the public library in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And it's an incredible room with, it's like a mezzanine on the top floor, and it just has views of the ocean. And there are a lot of tourists that pass through there constantly. And so, and there are children who, there's a children's room that sort of bleeds up into that space. But I even like those distracting noises. I focus inward as a result of them. So,
where could you never write?
I have never been able to write at home. I have a very nice study. I can close the door. It's quiet, but I'm incapable of writing at home.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Oh, well, I just got an email from a reader. Criticizing my grammar. So apparently every rule of grammar is the ones that I ignore. I don't split infinitives, like, you know, I don't care.
What was the first book you remember reading?
I'm sure this was not the first book that I remember that I read. I know it wasn't the first book that I read, but I remember like really loving Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes, which is about, you know, Boston and the,
yeah. What are you reading now?
I'm reading three things, actually. I'm listening to, this was a recommendation by a student, although I guess everybody else in the world has already read it, The Silent Patient by Alex Michaelides. Is that how you say his
name? Yep. Yep.
And then on my e-reader, I'm reading, I'm not going to remember, but the most recent novel by William Landy, who's most famous for having written Defending Jacob. And on paper, I'm reading a novel that I found on a, you know, table in a hallway somewhere, called The Beauty of Men by Andrew Halloran, who wrote most famously Dancer from the Dance in the 1970s. And it's about aging and loneliness and longings.
What book would you like to have written?
I should say like Madame Bovary or something, but in fact, like what came to mind instantly was Rosemary's Baby.
Oh yeah.
Which I think is like a perfect thriller kind of.
What sort of book would you like to write, but probably never will?
I keep trying to write a psychological thriller, but I don't seem to have it in me, but we'll see. I'm working on a book now that's kind of like an erotic thriller, but it's neither thrilling nor erotic. So I don't know what it's going to be.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I've heard I've gotten a few emails from people saying they miss my characters after they finish the novel, and that pleases me enormously because, as you indicated, my books are character driven. So
this has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Stephen McCauley, whose novel You Only Call When You're in Trouble is available wherever books are sold. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. Inside the Writer's Studio is proud to be affiliated with Libro FM. Unlike other audiobook platforms, Libro FM supports your local independent bookstore. Whether you buy a single book or, like me, a monthly subscription, you can link your account to your local store or to Bookmarks to support literary community. For a special 2-for-1 offer, go to Libro.fm and use the discount code WRITERS. If you've enjoyed Inside the Writer's Studio, please consider leaving a rating or review online at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside the Writer's Studio posts new episodes on the 1st and 15th of every month. I'm headed to the beach this week to read books for our upcoming episodes. But until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.